You're listening to Talk It Out, LGBTQ Voices in a Queer Election Year, presented by Gay City News and GayCityNews.com. I'm your host, Paul Schindler. Welcome to our debut episode of Talk It Out. After serving as Gay City News founding editor for more than two decades, I left that post at the end of 2020. Perhaps naively, I thought the election that November had put American politics back on track. But just a week into 2021, Capitol Hill erupted in the January 6th violence, and a poisonous political climate has persisted ever since. I recently went to Matt Tracy, my successor as editor of Gay City News, with the idea of creating a podcast to look in detail at what folks on the ground in key presidential battleground states and in critical U.S. Senate races are doing to stand up for sanity and decency in our politics and in our civic life. Talk It Out will focus most episodes on the election contests in specific states. Our discussions will help all of us better understand what's really happening in those states that will decide what our nation's leadership looks like come January. For about an hour each week, we're going to ignore the angry, overheated posts on social media. Instead, we're going to look to the people who are rolling up their sleeves to make a difference. Before we dive into the contests in individual states, we'll spend the first few episodes on the bigger picture nationwide. In this debut episode, we are joined by Brian Derrick, a political strategist working to help political donors maximize the impact of where they're spending their money. And we also talked to Dave Fleischer, a political organizer who has created innovative methods to help persuade swing voters by engaging in one-on-one doorstep conversations aimed at finding common ground. My guest is Brian Derrick, a political strategist and the co-founder of Oath.Vote. That's O-A-T-H dot vote. Oath.Vote is a group that aims to offer one-stop shopping for political donors who are looking to maximize the impact of their contribution dollars. Brian, thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you for having me on. I'm excited to dive in.
Brian, you've recently written that democracy depends on hope. Can you explain what you mean by that?
I create political content online and am known for bringing a bit of an optimistic lens and an action-oriented perspective to political commentary, political analysis. And I get asked a lot, how do you maintain hope? And I truly believe, and my answer usually is, maintaining hope is my civic duty. Because when we lose hope, we lose the ability to engage in our democracy and in our communities in a meaningful way. If you do not have hope for the future, that things can be better, a belief in the ideals of our country and in our ability to move towards our goals, and that the future can be better. Oftentimes we hear this phrase as the American dream, that the future that you pass down to your children will be better than the one that you inherited. If you do not believe in that, then the fundamental project of participatory democracy starts to fall apart because you have no reason to take action. There's no reason to vote or participate or run for office because why bother if things can't get better? And so we need hope to be that foundational piece from which action flows.
And you describe yourself as action-focused. Obviously, hope and action are inextricably linked to each other.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a separation there that has happened in the past few years, and I hope we can talk about it more, around people confusing education with civic engagement, and that being informed or reading the New York Times every day is only the first step in being civically engaged, because then you need to act on that information. Voting is the baseline. That's like that sort of absolute minimum that we can do, but we should aspire to do so much more than that. And if we have big goals that we want to achieve or big threats that we want to avert for the country or for our communities, then we need to do much more than simply vote every 2 or 4 years or simply just read the New York Times.
Let me turn your Democracy Depends on Hope around and ask you, how do you see cynicism and despair being marshaled to block progressive change or even in full-out anti-democratic ways?
More than ever before, it is being baked in to our systems of communication, into algorithms on social media, into what drives our more traditional media platforms, such as clicks and views on television. These systems are optimizing for negativity, for content that makes people angry or afraid, and overemphasizing and overrepresenting the most extreme and most negative perspectives incentivizes people to disengage from the system overall. I mean, think of how many conversations you've had in the last 8 years of people just saying they're just exhausted by politics. They can't possibly deal with another conversation about these people or this issue. That is the danger of cynicism, because it leads to apathy. And I think that having a more positive and more action-oriented diet of media is a critical component to cultivating that hope, warding off the cynicism that we see, especially in young people, through these platforms, and remaining sustainably engaged. It doesn't mean you have to go knock on people's doors every day to talk about an election, but it means being part of a community and being invested in the success of not just yourself, not just your family, but your neighbors as well. And I think that we've seen this pivot in the media ecosystem and through technology that has made it harder and harder for people to maintain that hope. And as you're pointing to, there are also people weaponizing that actively. I mean, including foreign actors. There's documented cases of Russian and Chinese interference in United States affairs, whether it's directly into an election or just through our cultural commentary, of having accounts that are just pumping out the most divisive and polarizing content possible. So it's a very real threat, and there are not enough people simply dedicating themselves to creating the hope that we need to survive this really difficult time, I think, in the American political landscape.
Brian, you're also well known for saying stop doom scrolling and start doing something. I think that's actually the tagline on your Instagram account. What are the negative habits that people have when they consume news?
There are many. We've seen a huge shift, even in just the last 2 years. It's been accelerated, of people getting less and less news from traditional newspapers, TV stations, and more from digital devices. Most of that coming from social media, but there are other sources there too. I think that what causes the most damage is how the platforms themselves put all information on an equal playing field, that there's no emphasis on fact-checked data over somebody's random hot take versus a bot that's not even a real person. It's all presented to you equally and in an endless scroll, so you don't even realize how much of it you're consuming. And so the most, I really think the top two most negative media habits that people have are consuming exclusively TV news, and we can talk about why that's bad, or consuming exclusively digital, also primarily video content as a news source, because of the, again, the incentive structures that are there to make you feel angry, to make you feel afraid, because that's what gets clicks and is driven through the algorithms that we all view the world through.
And I think our listeners are very well familiar with the problems on social media. Can you talk for a moment about your concern or complaint about consuming TV news?
I think that TV news has gone the way of social media in a lot of ways, because that's who they have to compete with. It's no longer just Fox competing with CNN, but they're competing with TikTok. They're competing with Instagram, because that's where people are now going to get this content instead. And so I think that most TV news has become more opinion-based, more inflammatory, and less what I refer to as like information dense. Like we at Oath, we're very focused on information density. How can I give you the most amount of information possible without overwhelming, right? While keeping things completely legible and digestible. It's the exact opposite. You have to watch an hour, 2 hours of TV news to get like the point of a couple of basic stories that are happening in the country. The amount of junk that you'll consume in that 2 hours really outweighs the value of the information that is conveyed.
Several years ago, Eitan Hersh wrote a book, Politics is for Power, which also had an action focus to it that you talk about. He asserted in that book that in 2016, 5% or less of folks who were daily news consumers and who had a fear of Trump being elected president actually did anything to support their side of the argument. Does that square more or less with what you're seeing out there?
Absolutely. I love the book. I think it is an incredible read for anyone who actually wants to make a difference in our political environment and affect the direction of the country. I've tried to switch sort of an old cliche. People say knowledge is power. And I say a lot on my Instagram, acting upon knowledge is power. Because simply sitting at home and listening to your podcasts and listening to the TV in the background and reading the New York Times and getting your push notifications and worrying, right? People are just stressed. They're like, oh my gosh, Trump is a threat to democracy. I can't believe it. I'm going to read all of the updates about all of his criminal trials, and I know everything that's going on. I know how much money the campaigns are raising. None of that matters if you do not do anything with the information. If you stay sitting at home this year and do not engage in the election, you might as well have gone to the beach. Like, why stress yourself out with all of this information if you're not going to do anything about it? So I absolutely agree that it has to be about that next step and putting that information to work for you. I do find hope in how many young people I think get that, because we have seen over the past 5 years, young people, I mean, and even before that, things from the Women's March to the response to George Floyd, to what's happening right now in the country. We see mass mobilizations. People are understanding that it takes more than an occasional vote. And I think that is what gives me hope, is that we're able to throw open the doors to democracy and say, come on in. It's a participation sport. There is nobody who's a spectator here. We're all in it together. And so you have to be willing to roll up your sleeves if you're going to make any impact at all. And I think that there's plenty of time left for more people to dive in this year.
So your effort, Oath.Vote, is focused on folks who are giving money to campaigns and to causes, and informs them on how to maximize the impact of those dollars. Can you first of all talk about the Oath itself? What is that?
Well, my background is in campaign politics as a campaign manager, finance director on political campaigns. And through that work, I learned how important fundraising is firsthand, that it's make or break for many political campaigns, especially down ballot. And so me and my co-founder, who I've known for over a decade, got together and came up with the idea of centralizing a lot of the information that we're kind of talking about here that you need in order to act really effectively and strategically in a single place on. And the unifying idea of the platform, the reason it's called Oath, is that the idea is it has every public servant that takes an oath of office on it. So from your local dog catcher, your city council, your state legislature, your governor, the president of the United States, they're all there and they're supposed to be working for us. So how do we enable people to be more effective in electing the individuals who are going to actually work for them? And so we wanted to build a platform that anyone could use without needing an advanced political science degree and very quickly behave like they are a high dollar strategic political investor, because those are the people who have full-time staff dedicated to this sole function of how do you spend money in politics in a way that can actually move the needle, because it's harder than you think.
Users on your site identify issues they care about. It might be climate change. It might be LGBTQ rights. It might be protecting democracy. And you then tell them what the best outlay of their dollars is. Can you explain how your team makes its evaluations?
The underlying principle is that many of the decisions that impact us most are not made in DC. They are made down the street, in your city hall, down the road, in your state house, and that those offices that most of us, vast majority of Americans, cannot name who represents them in those places. Those are the people that we need to really focus on to make a difference on these issues. Even the big ones, even something like climate change, it's local municipal offices that are making decisions about whether or not to expand fossil fuel infrastructure in their city or how the electric grid is going to work. And so we need to be focused on who we are electing into those offices. We have a team mostly of engineers who pull in data about these candidates and these districts from all over the country via APIs and web scraping, and there's manual research that goes into it. And we have this massive database that's able to, in real time, analyze the prospects of different candidates in different places, what's at stake in those races. So is that a state that's considering an anti-LGBT piece of legislation? Is that a state where we have the potential to reverse an abortion ban? And then we do mapping from those candidates who have a clear path to victory to the individual stakes of that election. So what actually changes if we win or lose? And then we also, at the same time, are looking at financial data. Okay, so super competitive race, really high stakes, going to be make or break. How much money does that candidate have? How much money do we think that they need? How much does their opponent have? Those three components we refer to as competitiveness, stakes, and financial need drive our algorithm that then can signal to a donor very quickly on a 10-point scale, 10 being the most impactful, how much can my dollars really do in this race?
I think oftentimes people will get a fevered email about a race and they'll pull out their checkbook and write a check. Can you talk for just a moment about who Amy McGrath was or is and what happened there?
I can. Amy McGrath ran for U.S. Senate in Kentucky against Mitch McConnell and is a great person, a great leader. She's a veteran and would be a wonderful U.S. senator. However, because she was running against the ultimate boogeyman for Democrats, Mitch McConnell, she was able to raise an absurd sum of money, over $100 million in 2020, to run against arguably a safe in a safe seat in a state that was safe for Republicans statewide. She lost by double digits, and we spent over $100 million as a party, as a community of like progressives on this race that had the same thing happened also at the same time in South Carolina with Jamie Harrison's race. And against Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham.
Right. Exactly. Another boogeyman. And so I'm not saying no one should give money to these races. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying there is a point of diminishing returns. We shouldn't spend an unlimited amount of money in these races, especially considering had we reallocated 8% of the total that went to just those two races, we could have closed the fundraising gap in every state legislative race in the closest 10 states where Democrats, liberals were being outraced. And so our theory of change is that the resources exist and that the intention that people want to elect leaders that are for these common sense things, it's all there. All of the components are there. We just need to do some more strategic allocation so that the donors who want to make a difference can find the races that matter most and can actually use their time, their money, and make that connection happen at scale, hundreds of thousands of donors at a time, in a really smart way in order to level up what the political strategy is nationwide.
I'd like for you to talk about an argument that you recently made, that it's important for voters to believe that Joe Biden can win in November.
I get a lot of questions, especially from people who are feeling some level of powerlessness, who are looking for a reason to believe or a sign that things are going to be okay. And in information environments that sort of stamp out a lot of that light and hope as soon as they can, I try to be counter-programming to lift up the things that algorithms do not lift up and that are harder often to find. So a good example of this, you think of a poll. If there's a new poll from the New York Times, Siena poll, or a Washington Post commissions a poll, if it's really bad news for Biden, it will get 10x the play online. The attention, the clicks, the comments, then something that kind of says that there's essentially a tie. But if the headline can be Trump beating Biden in 7 battleground states, that is going to go viral every single time. And so that's what's causing the sense of panic. And so I have been very intentional about laying out the case that there is an alternative to that. And the data supports an alternative narrative to that, that Biden does have a path to reelection. And again, it comes back to the same principle that if you can't believe that, if you can't convince yourself that that path exists, why would you donate, volunteer, vote even? And so we need people to see it. And it's not that I'm distorting the truth, or this isn't Kelly Conway's alternative facts. The data supports it. I've like very clearly laid out the case. When you look at like some of the more compelling points around what they call double haters or double doubters, the voters who say they don't want either candidate, Biden wins those voters by double digits, often 13 plus points. Those are the people who swung the election to Trump. The only time that he did win in 2016, they preferred Trump over Hillary Clinton, those double doubters. And so data points like that of what does Biden's path look like, and how can I help expand that path from one that could be narrow to one that could be wide, is a particular focus of both my Instagram, my Substack, because I do think that it's important for people to receive that message.
What's your sense of the Democrats' possibilities for flipping the House this year?
I love our chances of flipping the U.S. House. And I will say it is incredibly important that we do so. Number one, because while Biden has a path to win in November, so does Trump. I'm not saying that Biden is guaranteed to win. I'm saying there's a path for him to win. Trump also has a path to win in November. And if he does, it's imperative that Democrats hold either the Senate or the House or both to block a Trump agenda. We know what he wants to do in a second term, and it's pretty horrific. So we have to hold on to one of the two chambers to prevent a far-right Republican agenda from sailing through. Our best bet to do that is the U.S. House. And we can talk about the Senate. In the House, there are about 22, 23 toss-up races. That number will fluctuate a bit as the year goes on. We need to win 15 of them in order to flip the House. Another way of looking at this is that Republicans currently only have a one-seat majority. But when you factor in Democratic-held seats in North Carolina that are flipping to Republicans, and Republican-held seats that are flipping to Democrats because of redistricting. There are all these different components. The easiest way to think about it is there are 20, 22 or 23 really competitive races. We have to win 15 of them, which we can do. Is very achievable. In the Senate, to jump ahead of myself, we have a really tough map. The seven closest races in the U.S. Senate are all currently held by Democrats. Joe Manchin, unlikely to run as an independent, is not running as a Democrat, therefore handing one seat over to Republicans in West Virginia. Right. That means that if we go 7-7, batting 1,000%, our best case scenario is a 50-50 tie. Right. That's not a great position for us to be in. We have to win. Let's see if I can do it. Nevada, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Montana, and Pennsylvania.
Right.
And if we win all of those, then we'll end up with a tie 50-50 Senate. And if Joe Biden wins the White House, Kamala Harris will continue to be the tie-breaking vote.
And I assume that our listeners can continue to check in on your Substack for updates on your Senate prognosis.
Absolutely. And if you go on Oath, we have an impact score assigned to each individual race. So if you want to give $50 to a U.S. Senate race, we will show you where it's going to be most effective. And we will also show you which House races it will be most effective. Most of those U.S. Senate races that I just listed are expected to spend over $50 million in hard side spending, not to mention outside spending. And so if you are tuned in enough to be listening to this podcast and to be interested early on in the year in the election, then I would encourage you to look below the U.S. Senate and look at some U.S. House races, look at some state legislative races and other places that you can really make a big difference.
Brian, we could talk a lot longer. I do appreciate the time that you've given us, and I do urge listeners to check out Oath, OATH.vote. It's a wealth of very fascinating information on where you can make an impact in 2024 and beyond. So I thank you for joining us, Brian.
Thank you, Paul.
You're listening to Talk It Out, LGBTQ Voices in a Queer Election Year, presented by Gay City News and GayCityNews.com. I'm your host, Paul Schindler. My guest is Dave Fleischer, who is a political activist and organizer who for more than three decades worked at leading LGBTQ advocacy groups nationwide. Most recently, he ran the Leadership Lab at the Los Angeles LGBT Center. Dave has been a champion of an approach to public education and political organizing known as deep canvassing, and he's here today to offer insight into why deep canvassing is so important in this year's elections. Welcome, Dave. Thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you, Paul.
Before we dive into the subject of deep canvassing, can you explain to our audience what canvassing itself is all about and what the typical goal of canvassing is?
Canvassing is just having a one-on-one conversation with a voter. It usually happens when we go door to door. And a typical conventional canvass, those conversations are each going to last about 1 minute, at tops 2 minutes. And usually they're very, I'll just call it transactional. In other words, the gist of it might be, Paul, I'm a Democrat. You're a Democrat. We need you to vote for the Democrat. Can we count on you to vote for the Democrat? Thank you. And I'm gone. That's a conventional conversation in a nutshell.
So traditional canvassing, then, you are targeting homes where you have a strong belief that the person at that home is from your party.
You know, the whole history of modern American political campaigns in the 50 years I've been organizing is campaigns do less and less that is dialogue, and they do less and less at persuasion. What they really do is focus more and more on talking to a very narrow slice of the people who would be with us if we were willing to talk with more people.
So this is a very big election year from almost everyone's perspective. Why is traditional canvassing insufficient in this year's elections?
Yeah, well, and by the way, it's still a good thing, right? It just depends who you need to talk to. But in a high stimulus, high voter turnout presidential election year, it doesn't really make sense to talk to people who are definitely voting with us already. It doesn't really make sense to talk to people who, they might miss elections, but they never miss a presidential election, and they're with us already. And yet it's that second group that's going to get a disproportionate amount of these short conventional canvass conversations. But the problem is it's going to be a very close election, and a small number of votes in a small number of places is going to determine who wins. And so we need more voters on our side and voting with us in those places. Otherwise, the best we're doing is playing Russian roulette, and we've loaded three chambers of the gun, which, by the way, is not how smart people play Russian roulette.
So in 2008, a very historic moment in the LGBTQ community's history, California voters approved Proposition 8. Which overturned a state Supreme Court ruling from earlier that year recognizing marriage equality. What did you and your colleagues learn from our failure in Prop 8? And how was deep canvassing an appropriate response to that?
Honestly, Paul, in the beginning, nobody knew what an appropriate response was, right? Deep canvassing, that idea didn't really exist. What we did know is that every public poll prior to the vote on Prop 8 showed that we'd win, and then we lost. And so our community was really shocked and hurt, right? We think over time our lives have gotten better, and they have gotten better in so many ways, right? But what did it mean that a majority of people in liberal California were going to vote against us? Does it mean that maybe prejudice can't be broken down? And so there was this real sadness and anger and hurt. So the best idea I had was, look, we obviously don't know enough about these people who voted against us, a bunch of whom we thought were with us. So why don't we go to every neighborhood where we got crushed and seek out these voters and ask them what was on their mind? Why did they vote that way? And out of that, really just by listening at first and then by trying to make different points with them, we ended up learning an awful lot of things that didn't change anybody's mind, but what emerged ended up being a set of practices that did help us change people's minds. And that set of best practices is what we now call deep canvassing.
So in my distant past, I have done canvassing. And what I did was simply show up at a campaign office. I was handed a clipboard with talking points and a list of houses where I should knock on doors, and I was sent on my way. If I were to want to do deep canvassing, how much training would that require?
Well, gosh, a whole lot more than that. In fact, the amount of training you got there is pretty close to bupkis. You probably had a rotten experience and didn't want to go back. So right. I would say the amount of training you got there was insufficient even for conventional canvassing. For deep canvassing, when we're going out, for instance, in mid-April, we're going out canvassing in Philadelphia, talking to non-voters, people very unlikely to vote even in a presidential election. And the training that everybody's going to get is the Thursday night before that Sunday canvas. We're all going to get on a Zoom, and they're going to get an hour and three quarters to really learn the most important part of the conversation, which is where we tell a story about somebody we love and ask the voter to tell us a story about somebody they love. So that's a chunk of time, not quite 2 hours. It's fun. Then on Sunday, people show up and we start at 10 in the morning. And there's another, basically an equivalent amount of training. And that is where we role play practice the entirety of the conversation. And we also teach people how to read the walk list. We answer questions. We really make sure nobody walks out the door feeling unprepared. And then the third piece of training, I'd call it training, is after we go canvassing, we all come back together as a group and talk about how it went. We talk about what went right, what went wrong, where did we get stuck in a conversation. Because not everybody has a great day every time. Nothing in life goes that way.
Sure.
So when we all tell our stories and we get a sense of how we did as a team, including our tally of how many people as a team we were able to move to want to vote, even though they normally don't vote, well, then you realize, okay, we're making progress and we're learning. And you realize, hey, I want to come back and get the hang of this.
So I know, Dave, in addition to election campaigns, you've worked on a whole variety of deep canvassing efforts on issues from marriage equality to transgender rights. And certainly transgender rights are a critical issue today. I know a number of years back, you had a team of folks down in Miami-Dade County talking about transgender rights, concerned about the possibility of an anti-trans initiative down there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we were lucky to work with a really terrific LGBTQ group in Miami-Dade County called Save Dade. What a wonderful partner. And folks from LA and folks from Miami were very involved as we tried to make sure that even before the Christian Coalition qualified a ballot measure, we were talking to voters at high risk of voting against us. And it wasn't very hard to identify where they lived because Miami-Dade County's had a variety of anti-LGBTQ ballot measures over the years. So we knew where we needed to go, and we had the luxury of more time before we were going to have a vote. So we could go to voters that probably would get overlooked during the heat of a campaign, but really take time to see, could we reduce their prejudice against transgender people? Could we increase their support for including transgender people in the local non-discrimination law?
So we have an audio clip of one of the conversations that one of your volunteers, Virginia, did with one of the voters in Miami-Dade. And this is the very end of the conversation. I want to play that audio clip and then get your comment on the other side.
That but I tell comfort. You the truth, uh-huh. This is the first time.
Yeah.
And I thank you that I could ask questions like
yeah.
this and be responded with
yeah.
elegance. And
well, yeah, so that's why we're out here.
So, listen, oh. probably I was mistaken.
Yeah, like, so the thing about the comfort is that that's all it is. It's this big, because since a lot of people don't know someone who's transgender, there's a, like, an, I'm not even sure what to call it, but you know, just a fear of the unknown. The knowing that, like, that's what Lourdes faces is why, is a big reason why I'm out here today, because knowing when my partner, like your wife, right, like, when the people we love are dealing with something that impacts them daily.
It impacts you too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just to let your listeners know where that conversation started, we asked people to rate themselves on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is they definitely don't want to include transgender people in the non-discrimination law, 10 is they definitely do want to include them. And in the middle, they have mixed feelings. So it gives them a lot of room to illuminate for us that they're conflicted. Virginia, right after knocking on this door, asked that question, and the voter said 10. He was just fine with including transgender people. But he said it in a very tentative voice. So then Virginia showed him a one-minute video clip that showed local news coverage that was recent of both sides talking about this issue. Anti-trans people, as well as trans people and allies. And then, after that, Virginia asked him to rate himself again. And now he's a 5, not a 10. And so this is the exact kind of voter we're looking for. Somebody who's not a hater, but somebody who is not with us when he's exposed to opposition arguments that LGBT people and transgender people are in some way a threat to children. So Virginia then has this beautiful conversation with him, which I know we don't have time to show all of today, but you can see how far he's come, because at the very end, he's a 10, and now he's a 10, really having thought it through for himself. He's a 10, and he's going to stay a 10. So at the beginning of the conversation, he was using the word fag to talk about gay people. Now he's using the word gay and the word transgender. There's just a whole set of ways where Virginia has just taken the time without rushing to listen to him and then to help him reconsider.
And he thanks her for her elegant expression of ideas that he had not been exposed to before.
Yeah, because it turns out when we're kind to people where we think we may disagree, but we're kind anyway, we're really sincerely curious about what they think and how they see it, and we're not going to judge them or shame them. That's kind of the necessary prerequisite for us being able to help somebody decide they want to change their mind.
Dave, can you give us a snapshot of what research on the effectiveness of deep canvassing tells us?
Sure. So, and by the way, a deep canvassing, Virginia's conversation with this voter took between 15 and 20 minutes, right? Very different than a conventional canvas conversation. And existing research already showed that canvassing conversations were by far the most effective form of communication with, or voter contact is what campaigns call it. But deep canvassing really exceeded the expectations of the researchers because the results in the randomized control trial were so remarkably positive, not only about the magnitude of change, but the duration. So what we discovered is when we had these conversations in Miami, not only did people become much, much more supportive of transgender people and less prejudiced on a variety of measures, they stayed that way because the researchers followed up with them repeatedly 2 weeks after, a month after, 3 months after, 9 months after. The people whose opinions we changed, they stayed changed.
So I know you're working right now in the Milwaukee area in southeast Wisconsin. You're working in southeast Pennsylvania surrounding Philadelphia. Can you just mention for our listeners the names of the groups you're working with there?
It's very different in the two places. In Pennsylvania, where we're actually already deep canvassing, that's because we have a terrific local partner that we worked with before in 2020, Changing the Conversation Together. They're a wonderful group. Their membership includes people including many in Pennsylvania, but also many in New Jersey and New York and Connecticut. It's really from the whole region. And they're a great group. And if people live in New York City or Philadelphia or anywhere in DC, and they want to participate in helping in Philadelphia on a weekend, they can go to the website of Changing the Conversation Together and sign up. In Milwaukee and in southeastern Wisconsin, we're not yet deep canvassing. I've been having wonderful discussions with a variety of groups they're all going to do good things, but they've never done deep canvassing. And so I think they're figuring out what they want to do. I'm going to be in Milwaukee in mid-late April, canvassing for a couple of days with one of those groups where we're really getting acquainted. So that's all I know there at the moment.
So if someone is from either one of the swing states or lives nearby a swing state close enough where they can pitch in on weekends in the autumn, what should they be looking for in terms of an organizing group that tells them that it's worth their putting their time and effort toward?
That's a great question, because I can't tell you why this is true, Paul, but it is true that most of the activities campaigns do not have an impact on the outcome of the election. Or they have an impact that is so tiny that the amount of you're putting in a day of your time is not measurably going to change how many votes we get. And my advice to people is try not to do those activities. Your time is too precious, that the stakes are too high. So don't text bank. Don't write letters. Don't do things that are one-way communications where we're telling the other person what to do, especially if there's no dialogue involved. Don't post memes online that you find educational, factual, amusing. You're not going to change anything. And then you're going to feel really lousy if we have a bad result November 5th. So instead, seek out the campaigns that are interested in dialogue, deep canvassing, talking to non-voters who are on our side, but who often don't vote. It's very easy to find these people. They are highly numerous. It's more than a third of all Americans eligible to vote. And if you want to be part of seeing if we can do a little bit of persuasion with conservative, Republican, former Trump voters who are really conflicted. And that's about 10 to 25% of all of those groups. Really, they voted for Trump. They feel terrible about it. We ought to talk with them. There's no question, I think, that we're not going to have much of a democracy if we become so isolated from each other that we're afraid to talk with each other.
Dave, thanks for talking about ways in which we can better communicate with our fellow Americans during a very fraught election year. I appreciate you joining us on the podcast today.
Paul, thanks. And you know, if people are interested, I've been posting short pieces of writing on Substack every 2 weeks. And if you think you might like to deep canvas, but it's still kind of mysterious to you what in the world that is, because you only heard 1 minute of Virginia's conversation, go online, it's Dave Fleischer's Substack. And I have like 20 short pieces up. You can look at the titles and see if one of them appeals to you. But it'll start to demystify how you yourself could have deep canvas conversations.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks again to Brian Derrick, and to Dave Fleischer. And thanks to all of you for joining us for our debut episode of Talk It Out. We'll be chatting more about deep canvassing in several weeks in an episode focused on the critical swing state of Pennsylvania, when we speak with Adam Barbanel-Fried, director of Changing the Conversation Together, who is organizing on the ground in the city of Philadelphia. In our next episode, we'll speak to Patrick Egan, a political scientist and polling expert at New York University, and to Victoria Kirby York from the National Black Justice Coalition, a civil rights group working to empower Black LGBTQ people. Look for that episode on Wednesday, June 5th, on your favorite podcast platform.